Very few of the paramilitary leaders on either side of the troubles in Northern Ireland have ever spoken candidly about their roles in the conflict. However, in Ed Maloney's new book, Voices from the Grave, Two Men's War in Ireland, two former paramilitary leaders, one Republican, the other Loyalist, talk with unprecedented frankness about the parts they played in some of the worst violence of this tumultuous period. It's published by Public Affairs, and I'm very pleased that it brings Ed Maloney to our show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
Should we talk about this as something from the past? Should we be surprised that there was rioting just this past Monday in the northern Belfast district of Ardoyne?
I don't think we should be all that surprised. And if you read the story of Brendan Hughes's life, who's the IRA commander that features in this book, you will see that he ended his time in the IRA, a very disillusioned and disappointed person. Who believed that the peace process, while it is obviously praised and welcomed by most people in Ireland, for Republicans like him, was regarded very much as very short of what they had been fighting for. And the sentiment that he expresses in his interviews is one that's pretty widely shared within that community. So that's what you're seeing in Belfast at the moment.
Well, this was set off by the annual July 12th marches by the Orange Order.
Yeah.
And you would have thought that that was something that people would have been aware of diffusing as part of these changes that we've
Yes, seen. You would think so. And in the past few years, that is exactly what has happened. The majority Republican Party, the one represented by Gerry Adams, who was once Brendan Hughes' closest comrade, was able to exert sufficient influence over hotheads and people in these areas where the Orange marches come close to more or less keep things peaceful. But their influence has waned in the last two or three years, and the influence of the anti-peace process Republicans, so-called dissident Republicans, has grown. And you're seeing that reflected in the violence now.
On the other hand, it's also still very provocative to march in these Catholic areas. Couldn't some adjustments be made?
Well, indeed, this is the point that is made by and has been made by nationalist politicians since the start of the Troubles. Indeed, if you go back to the very origin of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, it's an Orange parade that sparks the thing off in Derry in August 1969. And as the Troubles intensified in this first two or three years, you'll see the role played by Orange parades going through or near Catholic areas like this, very much the spark for increased violence.
Do you think that the British government's apology last month for Bloody Sunday could have been a factor?
I don't think so, no. The apology for Bloody Sunday is something that everyone has been expecting. It's one of these...
But it does remind people that... There was a British role in all of this as well.
Well, you know, people in Northern Ireland, particularly those who live in these sort of areas, don't need reminding of that. So that's a daily reality to them. I think the Bloody Sunday Savile report, which as you said, made that apology, was not a surprise. People had been expecting it, really.
Maybe we should define terms before we continue. Are the terms unionists and loyalists synonymous?
They're not quite, no. There's a difference of emphasis. Someone who would be called a unionist would be more mainstream in their views, more respectable, more conservative. Loyalists would be unionists also, in the sense that they would favour maintaining the union with Britain and the link with Britain, but they would have a very strong Scottish Presbyterian streak of distrust of the British, which comes from the covenanting tradition from which a lot of Ulster Protestants derive.
Because many Scots were brought over to Northern Ireland at one point in its history?
Absolutely, and at a time when the covenanting tradition in Scottish Presbyterianism was at its strongest. And they are very distrustful of the British, almost, in fact, maybe sometimes more distrustful of the British than the Republicans.
What about Republicans and nationalists? Are those terms synonymous?
No, they're not. No, if you describe someone as nationalist, you're almost immediately defining them as being constitutional in the sense that they do not favor the use of violence to achieve their aims. They would see that standing for Parliament and arguing their case in the sort of normal democratic way is what they stand for. Whereas Republicans believe that that's really a waste of time, and that only the gun and the bomb can really make change. And of course,
for unification.
They're still both parties are still for unification. One by agreement, one by force of arms. And of course, the difference of the, that is defined by the peace process is that the leadership of the party that favored violence, Gerry Adams and people in the provisionals, have moved into the constitutional camp.
Although my sense is when talking about both these groups, or we're really not talking about two groups, we're talking about wide spectrums in both cases.
Of course we are, yes, and there's gradations within each of them.
And would people self-identify as unionists or Republicans?
Yes, they would, very much so, yeah, very much so.
Weren't things expected to change when the British government handed control of the police in Northern Ireland to local officials?
Well, some people would argue that it has changed, you know, that you do have, although we've had violence in the last couple of days, it's very much, small scale compared to the violence that we saw at the height of the Troubles. And there's absolutely no doubt that the vast majority of Catholics, call them nationalists or Republicans, are in favor of this peace process. Most of them do vote for Sinn Féin because they were the architects of the peace process. One of the major changes that flowed from the peace process was the devolution of power to local politicians, and then ultimately in more recent years, the transfer of control of the police, which was a very vexed issue throughout from the start of the Troubles and all the way throughout. So the fact that people like Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, his deputy, have some say now in the running of the police force is a measure of the difference.
My guess is Ed Maloney, Moloney. His book, Voices from the Grave, Two Men's War in Ireland, available in paperback from Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You didn't get to speak to these people, did you?
Well, I knew both men very well as a journalist working in Northern Ireland. But in terms of the interviews that were gathered for this book, I should perhaps explain the background. This is a project that was financed and approved by Boston College here in the United States. I went to them with the idea of creating this archive way back in 2001, when it was clear that the Troubles were coming to an end and that this was an opportunity to collect stories that very possibly could get lost, not least because the Troubles had lasted by this time 30 years and the participants were getting older.
Does it matter that it was in Boston rather than in Ireland?
Do you think
they'd be more open?
I think that, yes, indeed. I think there were a number of reasons why Boston was preferable. First of all, they were open to the idea in a very enthusiastic way, whereas similar institutions in Ireland would be a little bit leery of a subject like this.
Well, first of all, they would be seen as being pro one side more than the other. There'd be a bias problem with
very, there. Very, very possibly. And also there's a matter of trust. Unfortunately, we've had a few incidents in the past where paramilitary organizations have passed over their records to libraries and the libraries have passed this material on to the police. Now, that would not and would never happen in Boston, and the people who participated in this collection of this archive would know that, and therefore would be much more ready to talk to us.
So who actually interviewed?
Well,
them?
This is, I think, one of the interesting features of this whole project. We were faced with this great difficulty that normally oral history archives would be collected by professional academics, people who would be trained in interviewing people and so on and so forth. But the problem here is that the people who were going to be interviewed, the participants either on the IRA side or on the Loyalist side in the Ulster Volunteer Force, were people who'd been in organizations where the law of omerta was very, very strong indeed. And realistically, there was no chance at all that they would open up to your normal academic researcher. The other factor was that a lot of academic researchers would not be familiar with the very important minutiae of paramilitary life and rules and ethics and so on and so forth. And so we decided that perhaps the best way to do this was to recruit a former, and the accent on the word former, members of paramilitary groups who were academically qualified and who were capable of doing this sort of project. And we ended up with a guy, Anthony McIntyre, who was a PhD student, and he did the Republican side. He'd spent many years in jail. He knew the IRA inside out, and he's the sort of person who was trusted by them. And on the Loyalist side, we had a guy called Wilson MacArthur, whose family are UVF, He had a master's degree in political science. And so, you know, a pair of them, I think, were well qualified, and we sent them out. And I looked after the project from a distance and watched how it was going.
But you probably could have done this as well. But it is helpful that these two men were familiar with even the minutiae of this story, because it's a very complicated story. And if somebody made a reference to a certain event, the interviewer wouldn't have to say, "Well, what was that all about?"
Exactly. Although sometimes, of course, it's very useful to ask that sort of very simple question. But also, they had lots of common experiences. But I would actually make this point. I think there would be a lot of Republicans and loyalists who would be prepared to talk to me, but only so far. There would be a limit to how far they would go into the detail and so on and so forth.
Did they? Did these two men talk about similar events? Do we get very different versions of the same story?
We do, and this is one of the fascinating features of this book, I think, or the stories of these two men, is that their lives intersect at certain key moments. There was,
but they were both in the leadership of their groups, and we're talking about a fairly small place, aren't we?
Oh, well, we're talking Northern Ireland. We're talking about a tiny place, really. 1.5 million people, of whom maybe 1% were actually involved in paramilitary activity. So you're talking about a very small activist population, and they rose to the top in both of their groups. But they also had common experiences. One of the most traumatic was there was a terrible day of bombing in Belfast in July 1972, known as Bloody Friday. The IRA sent in 20 car bombs, which all exploded within a 20-25 minute period. And there was incredible carnage and panic in the center of Belfast as these bombs were going off. And, you know, people were fleeing from one bomb almost into the path of another, and the screams and shouts were just absolutely awful. Seven people died that day, and hundreds were injured, most of them women shoppers. Brendan Hughes.
The sort of thing we're seeing now in Iraq,
absolutely,
or in parts of Afghanistan.
Absolutely. Brendan Hughes was in charge of that operation. He was the operational commander on Bloody Friday. And it was the events of that day that finally persuaded the other character in this book, David Irvine, to join the Ulster Volunteer Force.
Now, a lot more pages are devoted to Brendan Hughes than to David Irvine. Is that because he has a longer story to tell?
There is a fundamental difference in their stories. David Irvine was certainly a UVF man, and he was a bomber for the UVF, and he was involved in quite a number of bombings. But his paramilitary career more or less ended in 1974. He went to jail, and when he emerged from jail in 1980, he became a loyalist politician, by and large, and his paramilitary activity ceased. Brendan Hughes joined the IRA in 1970 and left it in 1994. In between, he had risen to the top of the Belfast leadership of the IRA. He'd gone to jail. He'd been on hunger strike. He came out of jail. He was at the very top of the IRA again. His paramilitary career was lengthy and very controversial and very detailed and very interesting. So his story makes for a better yarn, if you like.
We will get both of their stories after we take a little break. My guest is Ed Maloney, whose book, Voices from the Grave, Two Men's War in Ireland, is available in paperback from Public Affairs. Stay with us. We're back with Ed Maloney, whose book, Voices from the Grave, Two Men's War in Ireland, is published by Public Affairs and now available in paperback. The first part of the book is devoted to Brendan Hughes. You say he joined the IRA in 1970, but what was his background before then?
Thank you. He was a very typical West Belfast Catholic. He left school at the age of 13. He came from a large family. His father had been a Republican, a member of the IRA in the 1940s.
But you say that he didn't. He says when he joined, he didn't have much of a political ideology.
No, he didn't. But a lot of IRA people, you know, didn't necessarily have a well-defined ideology. They knew basically what they believed in, and they also believed very much in the methodology of the IRA, the the gun and the bomb. And I think Brendan Hughes was very much in that sort of tradition. He was a merchant seaman for a while. He went to South Africa. He went
And what did he get out of going to South Africa?
What he got out of South Africa was the experience of apartheid. He went to Cape Town and he was apparently deeply affected by what he saw there.
Did he see parallels between apartheid and what was happening to Catholics in Northern Ireland?
Very much so, very much so. Although, of course, I don't think you could compare objectively the two situations. But he did see similarities in the sense that the Catholics occupied the same position in Northern Ireland as blacks did in South Africa.
They were being discriminated against.
Yes, and they were at the bottom of the social and economic ladder. And he says that very strongly influenced him. And he was also in Aden at a time when the British were fighting a war there as well.
So what led to his actually joining? He says, I just didn't become a rebel in 1970. I just didn't become a gunman. But he becomes a very radical figure.
That's right. I think his politics had been radicalized by his experiences as a merchant seaman, but his sort of Republican outlook in life had been shaped by his family experience, by his father, by growing up in West Belfast, experiencing the police there, experiencing sectarianism, and so on and so forth. And then when August 69 happens and you have the massive conflagration which leads to British troops being sent in for the first time. It's at that point Hughes is home on a trip from abroad from the Merchant Navy. He gets caught up in the riots and as a result of that joins.
But do you believe him when he says, I was never sectarian, I was never a bigot?
I think so. I think so. Although, you know, it's difficult often to believe that about anyone who comes from Belfast, given that sectarian politics and what have you, you know, play such a huge part in people's lives. But he was brought up in a mixed part of West Belfast, and the street that he lived in was mostly Protestant. And apart from the period that we're in at the moment, the July period when the Orange Marches take place, he had very friendly relations with all his boyhood friends. And he says that, yeah, he grew up knowing lots of Protestants, which was quite unusual for Catholics in that period.
There's often a moment or something that leads a group to go from being a protest group to being something else. And in this case, the IRA started engaging in acts of violence. And he was joining at that time?
He was joining at that time because there had been the riots in Derry, which brought the troops in, but these riots had spread to Belfast.
But those were not really organized riots.
Oh, well, they were organized riots in the sense that entire streets in Catholic areas were burned down. And the Catholic experience of that was that while these loyalist mobs rampaged through their streets, burning homes with petrol bombs, the police stood by and either did nothing or in some cases assisted. So there was very much a feeling that they had to strike back. And I don't want to get into too much complicated IRA politics, but the IRA was going through a transition at that time, the mainstream IRA from armed politics to peaceful politics. And they had been running down the armed side of the IRA. So when this happened, the IRA's traditional role of defending these Catholic areas could not be fulfilled because they didn't have the wherewithal. That led to a split in the IRA. And Brendan Hughes joined the, as it were, the hardline section of that split.
Now, when we talk about the IRA here, are we talking about only Northern Ireland's IRA or the old traditional IRA that was in the Republic of Ireland?
Well, there are so many IRAs, really, Leonard. You know, even nowadays, I think there's four or five groups that call themselves IRA, and one has to distinguish.
And one calls itself the real IRA.
That's right. Actually, I think that's more a media invention. Just as the provisional IRA is a media invention, it was not a word or a description that they chose for themselves. But you have the original IRA of Michael Collins, which fought the Anglo-Irish War. The defeated section of that Republican movement became the IRA throughout most of the 20th century. And then in the late 1960s and 1970s, you have a major split in the IRA between a Marxist wing going political and a more nationalist wing, which Brendan Hughes joined, called the Provisional IRA.
And the IRA had limited weapons and resources. How did it manage to stand up to the British Army?
Well, at the start, with great difficulty, they had weapons which had been collected from previous conflicts and stored away. And they brought those out and used them against the British. But in terms of modern warfare, modern armaments, Brendan Hughes played a very crucial role along with Gerry Adams importing Armalite rifles from the United States, which sort of transformed their military profile in Belfast, and for a while made them actually better armed than the British Army that they were fighting.
Is that why he was able to climb the ranks of the IRA to the top?
It was indeed. He was, by all accounts, a very efficient and skilled organizer of IRA operations, and that was his speciality throughout his life.
He went quite some time before he was arrested. How was he finally caught by the British?
Well, he was arrested in July 1973 after, I guess, 3 years of life in the IRA. And he was arrested along with Gerry Adams and a number of other very senior figures in the Belfast IRA who were holding a staff meeting, a brigade staff meeting to organize that week's activities, if you like. And we don't know for sure exactly how the British got on to the meeting, but there is a very strong suspicion that there was an informer, a highly placed informer within the IRA, who told the British about this meeting. They raided the house that they were meeting in, and there was Brendan Hughes and Gerry Adams, and they were arrested and sent to internment camps.
And then he escaped.
He escaped. I think he escaped in December 1973, 6 or 7 months after he was arrested. He managed to get out of jail he was inserted in an old mattress that was being thrown out along with other garbage and thrown into the back of a lorry, and somehow he escaped the attentions of the security forces and got through all the normal checks, and he was out and free and went back to Belfast to organize more bombings and more killings.
And then he was arrested again. And was he in prison during the time of the 1980 hunger strike?
He was. In fact, he was the leader of the prisoners, and he led the first 1980 hunger strike, the one that preceded the hunger strike at which Bobby Sands died. That strike is generally regarded as having been a failure, that the IRA prisoners did not achieve what they wanted to achieve. As a result of that, they determined to have a second hunger strike, and it was that led to Bobby Sands and the other 9 deaths.
When he finally made it out of prison, did he continue to work for the IRA?
He did indeed. In fact, he says that as soon as he got out of jail, he reported straight back to the IRA and became a very senior figure in charge of counterintelligence in the IRA.
Although near the end of his life, he began to doubt it. What happened?
Very much so. For a number of reasons. Primarily because he believed that the IRA had been thoroughly infiltrated by informers and agents by the British. And secondly, that the IRA leadership was not willing to do much about it. And he suspected their motives. He believed, I think, that it suited those in the Republican movement who wanted to steer the IRA towards the peace process and towards electoral politics to suffer military setbacks. And one way of ensuring that was to do nothing when informers were in your ranks. And that's what he ended up suspecting.
My guest is Ed Maloney. His book, Voices from the Grave, Two Men's War in Ireland. The other figure profiled in your book, as we said, is David Irvine, a member of the Ulster Volunteer Force. Tell us about the UVF.
Yes, the UVF. You asked me a question at the very start of this interview about the difference between unionists and loyalists, and the UVF would very much be in the loyalist tradition, representing that strand of Protestant opinion which is distrustful of the British, and you know, believes that the British will always act in their own interests and not their own. And
so this is kind of like a vigilante group that went after the IRA on its own, not trusting the British Army to do the job.
Except it has a very long and some would say noble history. It's the first UVF was set up in 1912, and it was set up in opposition to British plans to give home rule to Ireland, and it led to a massive revolt within the British Army against these plans for home rule. Britain itself was divided from top to bottom. The Conservative Party took up cudgels against home rule, against Lloyd George and the Liberals. British society was extraordinarily divided. The Protestants in Ulster set up this UVF. They imported hundreds of thousands of guns from Germany, which was at that point on the brink of fighting the First World War against the British, and they put tens of thousands of Protestants in uniforms, and that was the original UVF. It then more or less disappeared once Northern Ireland was partitioned from the rest of Ireland and retained its British status. But it reemerged in the 1960s as a result of a civil rights movement.
And the civil rights movement by Catholics.
By Catholics,
they were resisting
yes.
that.
They were indeed, yes.
Did the British Army treat paramilitary loyalist groups like the VF the same way they treated the IRA?
I think the argument would be that they did not. No, that there was a very
they looked the other way.
Very distinct difference. Yeah, that they often were accused of colluding with groups like the UVF, arming them, giving them intelligence. And sometimes going soft on them when it suited their purposes.
And how did Irvine wind up joining the UVF? Well, what was his background?
Well, his background, a very interesting background, like Brendan Hughes, very strongly influenced by his father, except in his case, his father was a bit of a paradoxical figure in terms of Northern Ireland society. He was very liberal, very open-minded, hated Ian Paisley, who was, of course, the great rabble-rousing Protestant leader of that day. But David Irvine admits that he went with the community pressure instead of with his father. And the community pressure was very much in the direction of either joining or backing organizations like the UVF.
How did he justify the actions of the group? What did he think about the Shankill butchers?
Well, one has to bear in mind that when David Irvine and indeed other loyalists are interviewed about the Shankill butchers, it's many years after the event. And you know, in this day and age, the Shankill butchers, and just to tell your audience, they were a gang of UVF people who toured the streets of Belfast in the mid-1970s, picking up randomly Catholics, whom they would then slaughter with butcher's knives in the most grotesque and horrible fashion. Those are killings that they are now ashamed of, and David Irvine is ashamed of them. But one wonders, did they really feel that way at the time?
What got him arrested?
Well, he was, as I said, a bomber. His speciality was blowing up Catholic bars. And he was on a bombing mission one night in late 1974, when again, one presumes there was information from inside source, from an informer perhaps. But anyway, he was stopped. And the troops found a bomb inside the trunk of his car, and the bomb disposal officer tied a rope around Irvine's ankle, and he held the other end of the rope, trained a pistol on him, and told him to take the bomb out of the car so that it could be defused, and then he went to jail.
Was he treated in jail the same way he might have been if he was an IRA member?
Well, he was, in the sense that all paramilitary prisoners, whether they were Republican or Loyalist back in those days, when they were either interned or jailed, were granted quasi-political status by the British, in the sense that they could wear their own clothes and they could run their own affairs, unregulated by and large by the prison authorities, very unlike most normal prisons. And they regarded that as prisoner of war status. And David Irvine ended up in a compound and a cage very similar to the ones that the IRA were in, under the same sort of circumstances.
It became apparent to many people that this couldn't go on, and we did wind up with a peace process and then a change in the political system. Has the situation for Catholics been improved a lot?
I think objectively it's undeniable that that's the case. I mean, you now have a very large and thriving Catholic middle class, which you did not have in 1969 and 1970.
Catholic able to be hired by certain companies and work for certain institutions they might not have been able to in the past.
Absolutely. And they dominate certain professions like the legal profession, which I need hardly tell you is as well paid in Ireland as it is in the United States. So, yes, they are doing much better. They now have a share in government power. One could say that most of the complaints that led to the civil rights movement in the 1960s have more or less been addressed.
So, how do we explain this this recent outburst of rioting?
I think it's an internal Republican matter. It's a case of being disappointed, like Brendan Hughes, of feeling that they were either sold out or let down by their leaders, and that their leaders have settled for something which they said they would never settle for.
The New York Times points out that many of the protesters were youths from Catholic districts in Belfast where there are very high unemployment rates.
That's right. And that's, I think, one of the major criticisms of the peace process, that while sections of Catholic society, the middle class, are doing very well and have their place in the sun, the peace process, and Brendan Hughes makes this point in his interviews, the peace process has by and large left behind the working class Catholics who formed the basis of the IRA back in the 1960s.
When you were working on the book, were you working from transcripts, or were you able to hear the interviews themselves?
I could do both, although obviously it's easier to work from transcripts.
But you get nuance when you do hear what people are saying.
You do. But mostly I use the transcripts.
Do you feel that you came to understand why these people did what they did? Because it involves something special to cross the line and engage in violent acts.
It does. Except that Northern Ireland is not a normal society. And I think what you're describing there is how people behave in a more normal society. Northern Ireland has been extraordinarily violent for a long, long period of time. The first sort of major sectarian riots in Belfast broke out in the 1840s and 1850s. And every 10 or 15 or 20 years thereafter, there have been explosions of violence. And I'm afraid it almost has become a normality for a lot of people in Northern Ireland.
Ed Maloney is a former Northern Ireland editor of the Irish Times and Sunday Tribune. He was named Irish Journalist of the Year in 1999. He has written A Secret History of the IRA, also a biography of Ian Paisley, and now Voices from the Grave, Two Men's War in Ireland. It is published by Public Affairs, available in paperback. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.